Thank everyone for coming, and we're here to talk about. What are we here to talk about?
Radio as a tool for change.
Radio as a tool for change. I just got a little hung up on the audio video aspect of it. I don't know if any of my co-panelists have a better plan for this. All I know is that my job was to show this little video, and the rest of y'all, I think, are talking about other parts of what you do with radio and social change. So, why don't we introduce our thing, and then we'll pop in the video, and then we'll stick to them. I'm Petrie. I'm from the Prometheus Radio Project, and basically what I'll present is I'll present this little video about a project that we did in Tanzania with a group of former Black Panthers that are running a radio station now.
I'm Ryan. I'm from Free Radio Olympia, and I'll be talking about some recent happenings in Olympia and the role that Free Radio Olympia played in the happenings.
I'm Kate. I just moved to Seattle from the East Coast, but I've done some work with community radio in El Salvador. I'm talking about my research there and on the kind of lessons that we can draw from their awesome community radio models that I think translate really well to the state.
And I'm Ani, and I'm with KABU Radio in Portland, and I'll just be talking about what I've seen anecdotally in my 20 years of working with community radio or being a member of listening to community radio. That I've seen make a difference in as far as social justice community action organizing.
Cool. Well, let me fiddle with this for a second. And is there a way to get the light?
African Alliance Community Center. We're better known as UAACC. UAACC was formally founded in 1991 by Brother Pete O'Neill and his assistant, yours truly, Mama Charlotte O'Neill.
We are an organization that is, I like to say, a continuation of the goals of the Black Panther Party. I am a political exile and have been so for the past 35 years. Our goal is to participate and become an integral part of the development of the communities in which we live. So when you see our community programs here, when you see our computer classes, when you see our English classes, when you see our empowerment through the arts classes for women, these are things that we were doing in the 1960s in the Black Panther Party.
One of the projects that the Indigenous Knowledge Class has been doing is going around visiting the elders in the community and interviewing them. So this is going to be so good, even with the radio station. You know, they'll be able to actually reach many more people.
Also just being sure that your station is communicating the message that you want to communicate to your listeners, and that your listeners are as much as involved in the programming of the station as possible.
And then gathering evidence from villages and trying to talk to them about music. And then try to explain how the music was all about and during their time and how it did impact to the community right now.
From 4:20 to 4:30, there'll be like a little bit news, and then after news, there'll be from 4:30 to 4:50. Maybe somebody can come, like a grandfather or a grandmother, can talk about maybe health issues. For example, if there is like issue concerning traditional medicine, that will be the end. So that's the program of WhatsApp right there.
So when you're going to be a producer for a show, you have to have an imagination. You must have the show in your head already, even before it goes on to air. And then as a team, find ways to make it a reality, something like that. Excellent work, Ruthie.
You have to remember, it's like a dance step. You go iron, solder, solder, iron. Where did you find it?
Right here.
Yeah.
Brown, black.
Wakati wa kutoa unaanza na nini, unatoa nini?
Bado unaweka kwa nini?
Unatakiwa nijifikishe hapa.
Kazi ndio hii, moja ya kwetu, moja ya kwao. And I made that.
You see that over there?
Watengwa means they saluted. The DJs on the radio station and the FM stations, they didn't like to play our songs. That's why we decided to be our own, to form our own community. That's why you see we are many. We are like 10 up in this crew. Have you had crew like gathered so many people like that? Have you? I don't think so. Which crew is that? The Wu-Tang Clan? It's not even Wu-Tang Clan, they have many people like that. Maybe they have family, but we are like 30 people in this school.
You go from there in the Mwana Matata Kingdom, Mimi Hapa, Alwatan Kuri, King Underground, Rapa, Yoko Hapa, Nanuka Kwapa, Sana, the lovely
nigga. Because we like our music. That's how we're living in. We're living in the music and we believe in the music, but we believe in God. That's it.
He says, Jonas Abibi, the bad man Angola, kill my people every day by day. And Allah will say inside and look at her. The money is so cool, it's called magic. So for us to make up a family to not say, Jonas Abibi, kill little boy. Jonas Abibi, kill little girl. Jonas Abibi, my people in Angola. Speaking again, Jonas Abibi, the bad man Angola. Kill my people every day by day. And Allah will say inside and look at her. The money is so cool, it's called magic.
Tuko katika majaribio ya kurusha matangazo yetu hewani. Ni 101.4, 101.1 UICC radio ya watu. Karibu sana. Ni mangoma tu hip hop kwa sana na reggae.
Come back to your home.
Particularly impressed with the fact that Prometheus Radio has given this very, very, very powerful tool, this radio station that will allow us to disseminate information. My old compatriot, Brother Eldridge Cleaver, once said that information is the wrong material of new ideas. I'm going to repeat that. He said, information is the raw material for new ideas.
The strong case of Africa on our side. It is important to understand that most of Africa will soon be independent.
Yeah. Put out the music.
Revolution is a process and not an event.
thanks a lot. Glad y'all got a chance to see it. I think it's like about 14 minutes or so, so I think we should just like talk to the other panelists, and then if you have questions about it, we can bring it up, you know, after the air when we started. So, I'd like to grab the mic and then start out.
Okay, so I guess I'll just
kind of
Portland, Oregon. We're a 38-year-old community radio station, independently controlled and operated in Portland by the community. We have a mission to serve unserved and underserved communities within the area, and to provide training and access to those communities to actually make radio, to create media themselves, to inform their communities and inform each other's communities as to our cultures and our struggles. So I guess one of the reasons I was really interested in getting involved with radio as a producer 16, 17 years ago was because I was a community organizer and I was working in a lot of different sort of pocket organizations. And I started realizing the common thread it's really fine with her. Not on. Mm-hmm. That's good for me. The common thread that we had between us was that we all used KABU as a resource, and that we saw that when we did use KABU as a resource, when our events were talked about, when organizers were interviewed, when things got on the community calendar for the station, then people actually turned out for our events and our meetings, and it was great. And when we didn't, maybe not so many people would show up. And so I started putting more and more energy into actually creating media for the organizations I was working with. Then, you know, over the years, I'm now the volunteer coordinator, and I don't produce radio so much anymore, but I believe it's the most important part of our mission is that we give training and access to folks that are otherwise cut out of the media. That in itself is a tool for social change. When communities are empowered to directly give their own message, to share whatever information they find relevant, whatever it is, however we can bring that out there to a wider audience, to inform both internal community and intra-community. That's going to make everyone's position stronger, and I think is really the essence of solidarity work. So to that end, at KABU, we really are trying to pay a lot of attention. You know, we in the left, have this habit of talking about diversity without really doing diversity. Going to the place of saying, yeah, we value diversity, but you're too different and you're threatening me. So how can we, you know, I guess that's sort of the challenge, I think, to really be true to the social change aspect of our missions and using radio as a tool, is to make sure that we're continuing to engage in communities that do not yet have access to this tool, and to continue to bring more voices in. And then internally looking at our organizations to make sure that they're actually culturally competent and we're not just expecting everyone to go to a normative value that is primarily, you know, middle class, educated, Eurocentric stuff because that's not diverse.
And so we need to challenge ourselves into, really, how do we make this real? How do we make this a multicultural, interactive movement? And make sure that all voices that need to be at the table can be at the table. How do we provide that space, that training, that support? How do we pass this on to the next generation? How do we continue to, not only increase the voices in this sometimes disharmonious choir, but how do we continue to reach out to make sure more people are engaging and listening and benefiting from the ideas that are being generated, or the music and the art being generated? So I guess that's my opening spiel.
Okay, I guess I can do it. I kind of bridge the Tanzania and Portugal, and then I'm going to do El Salvador. My name's Kate. I just moved here from East Coast, but I am really interested in community radio, but I'm by trade like a print journalist, but I'm really getting into the radio and potential of it. So I've been working with this radio station in El Salvador for a couple years now, and kind of visiting on off and on, spending periods of time there, and looking at the ways in which their community radio station there is really kind of engaging grassroots democracy there and facilitating different changes in the community. So drawing from that, like particular ideas and models and examples that I think they're really like universal as far as like how important communication is and community radio in particular. So the radio station I work at is called Radio Victoria. It's in rural, very rural, very isolated and very poor region of the country. It's about 2.5 hours outside of the capital, so it's pretty far out there. And I guess a little background on Salvador is that in 1992 they emerged from 12 years of war in which 75,000 civilians died. And there are a lot of high-level, the murder of 6 Jesuit priests, the murder of Father Romero. It was pretty atrocious, civil war, and before that a very oppressive dictatorial regime there. But Radio Victoria was born in 1993, immediately after the peace accords, pretty much. And it was literally born from Vencer Amos, the kind of famous radio station that was, you know, part of the guerrilla movement during the war. Like, they actually gave them the transmitter, so it was kind of very literally coming from it. And so the people in the community were of this particular community of Santa Marta. There were people who had been in Honduras during the war because they had been particularly civilly motivated and very organized and very progressive. So they bore a lot of the brunt of the oppression during the war. A lot of people in our community were killed. There were a lot of, you know, just ongoing military assaults on this community. So a lot of people had fled to Honduras. So after the war, they came back to Honduras and they had to reestablish their community. So one of the things that they were, when they were making a plan for their community, was they wanted to have some sort of communication, and it came up that radio is obviously going to be the most effective, especially since there were lower literacy rates, economics, and people didn't have access to newspapers and magazines, and so radio obviously became the most biggest impact way of reaching people in the community. So it started with about 6 kids, and now it's grown to a staff of 30 radio people who are there all the time, but everybody in the community is involved in some way. And everybody who works there is under 25, so it's really young. And these are like really literally the children of people who are involved in the guerrilla movement, but they also have this like new conceptualization is they don't want to be necessarily directly seen as part of this, the guerrillas and this kind of violent history in the country, but kind of moving away from that into like doing really revolutionary things with radio. So they just have totally interesting conceptions of who they are and how they're kind of continuing this revolution in a different format now. So they were a pirate radio station for several years, and then the government came in and took the equipment from a lot of the radio stations there. And this radio station wasn't one where they actually succeeded in taking the equipment. A lot of the other stations, the government came and seized their equipment. There's some great stories about other stations where the people, like the entire town came out and like, you know, threw it at the government until they went away and didn't actually succeed in taking their equipment. So, I mean, the radio stations are very much loved. And so after the equipment problems, they had started petitioning the government for legality, and they didn't actually succeed in being granted a legal way of operating on the airwaves there, but they eventually formed an association with the other, there's 12 major radio stations in the community radio stations in the country, and a bunch of new ones have been cropping up over the years. But they bought frequency, they pulled their money, formed an organization, it's called ARFAS, and they pay for frequency together, and they all pay a portion of it every year, which I think is a really interesting model for being a little more sustainable. So because they don't actually intercede, like they don't actually cover each other's regions at all, because there's not really much overlap, they can pay and they can share the same frequency in the country. Which is going to be a problem because now there's some of the stations that are getting big enough that they're going to start overlapping. So we'll see what happens there. Yeah, it's just expensive. Okay, so some of the things that I was looking at there as far as the ways that radio stations actually been a really huge impact on the community is that it just pushed it clearly, like it spread the way for like participation on the part of the community members. It's really like the phrase that they use there is to democratize the word and to have more people able to speak on the airwaves and to get their voices out there. And it's interesting that they also have a very strong history of a popular education model in which people are learning from each other and they're teaching each other and there's not somebody who's like necessarily the... it's not a top-down model of education. They kind of transferred this into radio voice as well. And so radio stations also provided just a dialogue between people and between people in their government. People are actually discussing these issues on air that are important to them, whereas there wasn't really a whole lot of room for any kind of conversation before the war and during the war, and immediately after it's kind of evolved out of that. And then just some of the different things, like people are a lot more comfortable with media now, like people in the community are able to talk on the radio and they can see that it's not just only commercial models of communication, but that you know, their neighbors can be on the radio. And it's just really interesting to see like companies they're talking about CAFTA, and rather than just hearing politicians talk about CAFTA, but actually being able to talk to one-on-one people about how it's actually going to affect them. Mm-hmm. And people not being weirded out by putting a microphone in your face. Like, it's not this totally like important people in the Capitol or who are in the media. It's people that you know. And just another thing is that they have a very internally democratic structure. No voices are more important than others. It's just very, people actually listen to each other and have important conversations about like the direction of the station. And there's just a lot of, every voice is heard. And what's particularly interesting is that in a lot of parts of Latin America, it's like to be openly like homosexual or to have any kind of lifestyle things are different. But at every single radio station in El Salvador, there's somebody who's openly homosexual. There are people who have had very different histories as far as like where they came from to the station, and they seem to be like very accepting places because they've actually really embraced this kind of dialogue and democratic models. And then, so one of the other things we've seen there is like some very tangible changes that they've had in the community, which is, for years the teachers in the community weren't being paid because they were popular educators. They weren't actually like certified by the government, so they weren't being paid the salaries they should have been being paid by the government, even though they were the only teachers in the community. So the station was really highly involved in like petitioning the government and like really putting pressure on them to pay the teachers in the community, especially after the teachers got certified. So they were really like on top of that. They have the road that leads to the village is terrible, and actually after years and years of kind of really campaigning and using the airwaves to talk to people about the importance of this road and to talk about the conditions there, they like succeeded in getting the road redone. And then one of the most significant things that we've seen there as far as change is that, like you said, other community groups are able to use the radio station as a means of amplifying their own projects. So they have a very active group that talks about AIDS and sexual health there, and they use the radio station to put out this information far and wide. And it's actually interesting that a lot of organizations in Honduras now have been requesting the kids from this organization come there because they can hear about the programs on the radio. So they're actually across the border, and it's not actually that far. You can actually see it from where the village is. But they only know about these programs because of the radio, and they don't have a similar AIDS and sexual health program in Honduras. They've been calling the kids in our community to come over there and talk about these things. But in the 5 years that they had this program on the radio about AIDS and sexual health, the teen birth rate went from 25% of total births were to teenagers. Now it's gone down to 6.5%. And just in 5 years, so it was really impressive. I mean, the AIDS organization is amazing, but the ability that they had to amplify that message by the radio was just astounding. But there's a lot of other different things the radio does as well, it's just beyond just this kind of basic providing information. It kind of provides a forum for reflection, especially for a country that's coming out of 12 years of civil war. There's a lot of need for talking about what happened there and kind of reflecting on that and remembering that in the interest of not having those kind of things repeated. And this kind of collective memory idea so that they are using their radio programming to talk about these things and to keep these issues alive, because they're not in textbooks, and kind of a lot of things that happen to normal people there are not recorded in the history of the country right now. And then there's also like very political programming that's led by the children that talks about like really important political happenings for them. It talks about CAFTA, it talks about a lot of the different neoliberal trade policies, it talks about the dollarization of the country. A lot of things. El Salvador doesn't have their own currency anymore, they use the American dollar. So they talk about issues like that.
That's a mistake.
Yeah, it's really weird being there and using American dollars. It was totally weird to me out the first time I was there. And it's also, it's let them play music that's not American music. They play music from people in their community. The kids have a really awesome band, and that's who's on the radio. And you know, the people who wrote a lot of these songs that are about the experience in their community and in their country and you know, in Latin America in general, they're not listening to like Britney Spears, they're listening to Salvadoran music. And also, a lot of them just talk about the history and kind of keeping alive this people's history of what's happening there, and not just listen to textbooks. And so it really creates, and a larger thing is that it creates this alternative to globalization, that they don't have these outside models of history and politics and music. They're having their own model. So it really creates this alternative to that. And one of the most important things I've seen there is just that it keeps youth in the community. I mean, like 20% of Salvadorans are in the U.S. Because they're looking for jobs here. Especially, they're mostly young people. They're people who are, 17 to 30 is like the highest rate of people who are leaving for the U.S. But for these young people to be able to stay in their community and to make an impact there is really important. Because a lot of times people would leave. And so the radio station is totally self-sustaining now. They have equipment grants from outside organizations and in international organizations. But for the day-to-day programming costs and for the paying, the staff receives a stipend, it's all from generating their own advertisements. Like it's like local shoe shop, ice cream shop, the grocery store, that kind of thing. They pay for advertisements. So they're able to pay all the kids to work there. So the kids are making, it's not tons of money, but it's enough that they're contributing to their family income and they are able to stay there rather than having to go to the capital to work or to leave the United States. So it's actually like investing in the future of the community and having these young people who are going to be productive citizens and to be really like, helping people, do good things in their community. They're going to be able to stay there. And another thing is just the existence of the radio station itself is positive, that they're actually be able to be there legally, and that people see this radio station as an actual means of change. It's, worlds away from where it was, 20 years ago, where, people were being oppressed by a government model that was just not at all attentive to people's needs. But while this outside neoliberal model is still, pressing them in many ways, there is advancement here on this grassroots level that people have this kind of facility to have these conversations and to hear the head of voices heard. The big questions I draw from it is just that it creates a public sphere and dialogue and participation and a validation of your experiences and also something for youth to say in their community, which I think is really important here as well. So,
how did you get connected with that?
I studied in Nicaragua in college, first semester, and I went to visit, and they by chance took me out there and fell in love with it, and so I kept going back after that. So.
And was there a radio station when you went out there?
Oh, it started.
Yeah.
Oh, and I didn't start it. No, it's been there for. Oh. It started in '92. I started going a couple years ago and checking out what's going on there and recording history, talking to people, and learning from these models. But no, I just graduated from college, so I just kind of been an ongoing research there. There were probably 20 that started right after the war. Now there's about 12 that are have a constant presence. That are bigger ones, but there's smaller ones popping up every day. There's a couple ones that are really tiny that are just here in the immediate community, but there's 12 that are covering entire departments. Yeah, I spent most of my time at Radio Victoria, but I actually got to travel around to a lot of the other ones and see what was going on there. So,
what
They're not all the same, but they all have like really similar kind of models.
I'm Ryan, once again, with Free Radio Olympia. And for those of you who don't know, Free Radio Olympia is an unlicensed community radio station. And yes, we do consider ourselves a pirate radio station. We see what we're doing as a form of direct action against the state. We don't believe that the airwaves should belong to anybody. And we're doing this to exercise our right to speech and make statements in the airwaves as well. And let's see, FRO itself, I think an important part of FRO is that it's a non-hierarchical organization, and we work as a collective. All the decisions are made by the collective, and people are welcome in the collective to participate as much or as little as they want. And as well, we make it so that anybody in the community can join. We have a very limited budget to like do advertising and outreach, really, but we have forms online, and anybody can email us and express interest, and we're very good about getting back to them. In fact, we just took in quite a few people just recently. Let's see, we're very rooted in the community, which I think is very important and provides a lot of diversity on the airwaves. There's definitely a part of the community we are. We relate very closely to groups like the Free School in Olympia and the Indymedia Center, which is based out of Media Island downtown. And also we relate with groups like the Female Hip Hop Alliance. And we've worked with groups such as Stonewall Youth, which is an LGBTQ youth group. Of course, the school is nearby, so we have a lot of interaction with Evergreen and SPSCC to some extent. UCAN, Fertile Grounds, which is a group that has a garden in an urban area, and also GRUB, which is a community garden helping youth, that has youth come and help learn farming skills within the city limits of Olympia. A lot of our shows are very relevant. FRO always takes, you know, sides with the social justice movements of the town, and it's really exciting because it's given me the opportunity to work with a lot of different people. We have some interesting content in our station that aren't heard on many others, and some of it is. We have a show called Conspirazine, which you can hear every Saturday and also download off of line, which ranges in interesting to what the hell are they talking about. And we also have a show called Cop Watch, which Drew Hendricks does, and that's a very important show. He gets out there and he cop watches and videotapes police and investigates what's going on with the police in the community. And through that show, we've come to, there's definitely been some pertinent information to the community that's come through on that show and through Drew's work. Also, we have shows. Just recently, my friend DJ Blackbeard was interviewing folks down in Oaxaca about what's going on with the strikes, the teacher strikes down there, and he did about an hour-long special on that. And I think what's important, one of the most important things about Free Radio Olympia, as with most independent media projects, is that it encourages action. It's not just, obviously, I think that's what we're all here about, and I think Free Radio Olympia does a good job of doing that. Let's see. Just recently, there was a Free Radio Olympia played a vital role in actions that went down. The Port of Olympia recently militarized, and they shipped in a striker brigade. Well, a striker brigade came from Fort Lewis down into Olympia. And between March 19th, when it started coming in, to March 31st, Free Radio was on the air. If there was something going down, somebody was in the studio, telling people about it and telling people where to be and how to get involved and how they could take part in the actions, you know, where to be in the streets. And that began on March 19th, once again, and the first 3 days, Free Radio helped, well, all through the time it was there, Free Radio was announcing vigils that we held each day, and also helped organize a blockade, let people know about meeting times and planning times for the actions. And also, Free Radio was broadcasting while folks were down at the port. A group marched from a rally, a vigil that was being held on the corner, to the front gate of the Port of Olympia, and the whole time Drew Hendricks, once again, was on the air broadcasting and telling folks what was going down and gave the play-by-play. So folks who couldn't be there at least knew and could get down there later on. Mm-hmm. And, Pro was instrumental in this time. So it was very good to have, you know. And Fro has a lot of flexibility as a station. We have throughout time about 300 people have come through the collective. Currently there are about 60 people more or less active in the collective, and it's completely freeform radio. So besides our news programs, all the content is completely created by the person who's doing the show. We don't have PSAs. We're completely funded by fundraisers, money out of the pockets of our own collective. So, we really have the flexibility to take the time to encourage action and participate in the Olympia community. Yeah.
Does your radio station yell fire in the midst of the theater?
No, I wouldn't say it does.
What was the question?
Does our radio station yell fire in the midst of the theater? No, we are on the air because it's always necessary to get more voices out there. You know, licensed or unlicensed, it's important. if there's a need felt that more people need to get on the air, I mean, by all means.
So you have a responsibility to...
Oh, certainly. I think we have a responsibility to our listeners, and we don't have any limitations. Well, we have one limitation to what we say on Free Radio, and that's no hate speech on the air. And, I mean, that, of course, is up for debate consistently. But, no, we're not out there just like... Yeah, well, I mean, to some extent. But we're there for a purpose, you know.
How long have you been in here? And do you have a sense of how many people are listening at a given time, or what the maximum
is? Yeah, that's...
Who's listening?
It's difficult to gauge, you know. We don't have what the Argotron is called.
Argotron,
yeah. They don't do our ratings, mm-hmm. you know. And, we broadcast at 100 watts, and we've been on the air since 2001. We had a short time where we came off the air when the FCC slipped us a note, but then shortly after that, the National Association of Broadcasters came to town. Of course, they had to be there with the transmitter broadcasting in the cracks stations in Seattle, and that really politicized the collective. They got back on the air right after that. And I'm sorry, I totally distracted myself from your question.
How many people listen?
How many people listen?
And do you have people who are resistant? Have you ever invited them and they're like, I'm not going to be involved because it's a pirate station? Mm-hmm. Or how many people?
You know, there are mixed responses, of course. For the most part, like as far as the people I've invited on with me, there's been no resistance. They're like, oh, cool, you have access to the airwaves, that rocks. And although there are some people who get a little nervous about it, we've had people who might work for the city who've said, oh, I don't want to risk coming on. And we certainly do, to some degree, have, you know, we're come from from a place of privilege that we can go on the air as a pirate radio station. As far as the number of listeners that are listening at any one time, we've got a poll running on our website, and we've had 158 different hits saying where people are listening. I think actually our listening base is much bigger, and it definitely builds momentum. Like right after the port actions, I know a lot more people were listening than on average, and definitely, right? Like, there's no real way. Like, I don't know, but we do know we have a fairly large listening audience in the Olympia area, and I think I didn't realize that for a long time, but the more time I spent at the station, the more I realized, like, I'll be out and I'll spot somebody with a Fro shirt that I've never, ever seen before, and I'm like, yes. Yeah.
So do you operate on a two-mile radius?
Our signal goes from probably about down to Lacey and then up to right as you begin to go into the Nisqually Valley.
How do you stay on the air? Don't they try to shut you down?
Well,
the FCC slipped you a note. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, the FCC slipped us a note because, as we assume, there was a complaint filed, and the FCC, of course, works on a complaint basis. So we've actually bebopped around the dial, and we started at 91.3, then we moved to 101.5, I believe it was. And then on 101.5, another station said that we were interfering with their signal, and we moved to 98.5, where we've been broadcasting ever since I've been there, which has been about roughly 2 years.
So they don't try to shut you down, or do you really have to physically keep moving around?
Physically.
Something about being comfortable. You were supposed to be broadcasting from a place that was relatively comfortable. I mean, you're not like athletes because you're on this pirate radio.
I'm sorry, what?
It's not like any government entity is trying to seek you out.
No.
Okay.
You know, at least I don't think they are.
Your knowledge.
And we haven't, since that first note from the FCC, we've never received anything else.
Ryan's your real name?
Yeah, Ryan's my name. I go by DJ Rhino on the air. I upload some of my stuff as DJ Rhino.
Is there any cross-pollination? I mean, you probably answered my question, but are there any of the other radio stations that you can share with your work?
Yeah, certainly with, as COA is coming up right now, KWALP, and in Olympia, we've definitely worked closely with them. And then, there are bridges between all the folks at Fro, and certainly there are connections with Chaos, whether they be apparent or not. And, folks who are interested in radio just make those connections. Hence, we're here.
In reference to your question about the FCC, I found out here from the East Coast, in the 70s when we were doing private radio, the FCC was on every other day. But I find it out here, and this is one of the problems with low power radio, that the FCC, they're outside of Seattle, or there's not very much in the way of their monitoring a lot of the things that are going on around, unless they get complaints. And then they begin to lock in. It's not like down in D.C. where the FCC is situated, where they're going to maybe have trucks going around and stuff like that. It's not that way.
Although I've got to tell you, there's a station that was put on, anyone that saw the video last night, the station that was put on the air that night in 1998, they're still on the air. I can't even believe it. they're about a mile and a half away from the FCC, and they've been on the air pretty much continuously. For 8 years ago.
Hey, there's some bush cutbacks we can live with.
Yeah. Who knows why? Maybe someone listens to them and
they
like them.
Are they here? I don't know what's
up. No, Washington, D.C. It's a station that we started during that pirate radio march. I mean, we couldn't have attracted more attention to it. I mean, go down at the FCC. I mean, and we launch it that night, there are television cameras, there's all kinds of things. And
Yeah, and then they just like kept on operating and kept on operating.
That's a beautiful thing.
I'm totally befuddled by how it happens, but that's there for still there.
It's all those big ways. They don't know how to run that little truck.
Question. I'm sorry, the question of censorship comes into my mind about all of you guys. In El Salvador, what was the censorship like? Is there censorship today? Cable, and with what you were doing, P3, in Zambia, I mean, what's happening from the government side of censorship? What's happening from the professional journalism side? That's a question all of you guys.
Well, I don't know how many people were at the indecency workshop earlier, or what all has been said about it so far, but at Kebu, you know, the indecency standard from the FCC is you have no material that graphically depicts sexual acts, excretory acts, that's indecent material and not allowed between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., there's safe harbor where more things are allowed. The interpretations of those of that rule has become ever more restricted over the last year or so. I mean, you know, it's like it feels to me like it's sort of this ever more restricting, quickly sort of spiral. So Kebu has always sort of had the philosophical, I don't say always, I guess I shouldn't say always, since 89 when I started getting involved, Kebu's had, at least since then, the philosophical angle that we push the envelope. We don't jeopardize the community's resource, but to serve the interests of free speech, we put our toe on that line and we try not to step over that line. For example, we had a program. Well, we had an FCC complaint, and were notified of a fine. Maybe four or five years ago now, that was because a woman played Sarah Jones's "Your Revolution," which was sort of a feminist hip hop. It didn't have any of the seven deadly words, but it had some innuendo in it because it used lines from commercial hip hop that was readily played on most commercial stations. We defended that. We said that's not indecent. That's free speech. That's social commentary. That's socially relevant. That's important information. That's important culture. And we didn't pay the $7,000 fine. We paid $13,000 of legal fees and had it dismissed. You know, but at the same time, it means that that song was deemed not indecent, which allows radio stations to play, and allows. I felt like it was a pushback of, yo, you know, you don't get to just say this because it's politically uncomfortable. You know, this is not indecent. We're not going to cave. Now, that said, in the last year or two, most of the defenses that we used have been taken. Like context, social relevance. These are not defenses for indecent speech any longer. This is my understanding. These are some precedents that have happened in the last, you know, year. That all of the things that we could say, well, no, to serve free speech, we need an opportunity for satire and for social commentary, for things that are socially relevant, said in many different ways, not just in this one approved way. And all of those defenses are pretty much gone. The fines have gone up substantially from, I think it was like, you know, $15,000 or $20,000 cap 4 years ago to now $350,000 maximum, which is half of our station's budget and more than many stations' budgets annually. And so we're advising at this time. In fact, I'm... starting last week, and talking to each and every one of our 200 on-air program hosts to let them know that all of the defenses are no longer there at this time, and that we cannot risk the community's resource. And this is not the time to push our toes to and over the line but to really be very careful about indecency while we coordinate with other stations through grassroots radio network, through organizations and coming togethers like this, so that we can educate the broad public and so that we can create political action to change those rulings and make each other safer. But right now, it's not really the time for a licensed station to push their toe over that line.
When you say taken away, do you mean it just takes the precedents that were set in the court, or were there rulings that the FCC gave so that administratively it could then change?
Rulings that the FCC gave, and they haven't been overturned by a court. There was something last week, and I don't know if any lawyer present. I don't know if anyone paid very close attention to what that ruling is, but there was something a week or two ago that was like the first time I'm aware of in the last year that something wasn't that there was a little opening. But I'm not. No, I was preparing for something entirely different.
So, kind of what's happened in the past little while is that the FCC. Put out a really a very tough set of rulings, mostly on broadcast TV, none of it on radio at this point. But what they did for the first time in their history, the seven dirty words are actually a myth, and it's funny how they've become a reality, but they were actually invented by George Carlin. And so they never had anything to do with the FCC. And the FCC standards were always about context, and did it have artistic merit, did it have, or was it merely intended to shock and pander and titillate? And what we saw for the first time about 6 or 8 months ago was that the FCC started not only regulating indecency and obscenity. Obscenity has no socially redeeming value, and it cannot be played anytime. Indecency might have some, and it can only be played when children are not likely to be listening. But they also added, for the first time, they started regulating profanity. This series of rulings, it's like the funniest thing you could ever read, because it's basically explaining why they find dick breath to be not profane, but fuck and shit to be deeply and profoundly offensive. So there are two deadly words right now, which are shit and fuck, and certain variants thereof, such as shitty and fucked up, and a series of limitations.
Mm-hmm. But things that are carried in Webster's.
But then there's a whole other sort of class of words that are very offensive but do not meet the profanity standard that was set in that document. And so where we are now is that there's at least one FCC commissioner that says, I think we made a mistake. We never should have ruled that way. And in fact, a bunch of the TV broadcasters, commercial broadcasters, went back and sued the FCC and took them to court and said, you know, this ruling that you have, it's a dramatic change, and we don't think it's warranted. And so what the FCC did was they asked for reconsideration. They said, okay, we made the decision, now we're getting sued over it, maybe we should look over it again before the court steps in, which meant that they were afraid that the court would actually overrule the FCC on whether there's that big a difference between dick rap and so that's what's happening right now. So the FCC is going back over that.
Was it the Third Circuit? For some reason.
I can't remember where they brought it.
What did
they? I can't remember where they brought it. It was all the commercial broadcasters there. So they probably...
Unlikely.
In the mid-90s, when I was doing their show and the radio stations, that was pretty much the highest form of censorship there. Since then, there isn't a lot of direct censorship on what the radio stations are saying on a day-to-day basis. But a lot of that's because the community radio there is so well supported in the community. Like, when they tried to take away the equipment in the 90s, people came out and, chased the government away. Ever since then, the support's really just grown. And, Souter's an interesting model because the arena party is in power as far as the presidential right now, which is the more conservative, more controlling party. But in almost every district, and on there's an overwhelming majority of people who are from the FSLN, who are in power. And so these people who are really supportive of the community radio stations. So it's a really interesting political dynamic where, because of the U.S. is supporting the arena party in presidential elections, and because there's a lot of people being forced, they're being told not to go vote there in presidential, and there's a lot of voter intimidation. But as it translates to the community, people are still voting for elected leaders that they really think are going to do a good job in their communities. So I think there's this really immense protection of the stations that kind of keeps them from actually being very highly censored. But they do walk a fine line. And there's a lot of self-censorship as far as things trying to be not very as openly adjective as they might like to be. And I think a lot of the kids that on the radio station tone down a lot of their own political beliefs on the radio just because they want to keep the radio station open.
In terms of the other one, Tanzania, they've actually had a fair amount of trouble actually getting their completed permit to broadcast. I believe they're on the air right now, but I haven't checked in a little bit. But I think actually a little bit more closely between those two topics. I recently visited Venezuela, where there have been a lot of changes over the course of the past couple of years in media, and I found their approach to these sorts of questions of government censorship really interesting. For one thing, the community radio stations were more or less ignored by the Chavez government for the first two or three years of him being in power, even with his radical program. But they played a very important role in sort of saving his presidency from the coup that was actually pretty much run by the corporate media and some business elites there. And since then, they've undertaken a very fundamental overhaul of their broadcast home. And the way that they approach a couple of these questions, I just find really interesting. One is they do have laws against indecency and obscenity, but right up there with indecency and obscenity is violence. And so they consider that as serious an offense as potty mouth is depictions of violence, and in their words, as rational solutions to social problems, or rational solutions to conflict, to human conflict. They also have a law against depiction of gambling as a reasonable alternative to work. is another thing that they consider right up there with any kind of indecency or obscenity. The way that they deal with fines is that instead of giving these $325,000 fines, and they'll give it to Howard Stern or they'll give it to KABU, what they do is they say that the fine for these things is 1.5% of your gross revenues. So small stations are impacted by that much, and big stations are impacted proportionately.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that they do is that money doesn't go to the Treasury. That money goes to the Social Responsibility Fund, and the Social Responsibility Fund is what is taken to make non-commercial programming. And so that money is distributed to community radio stations, to public radio, and so forth.
Okay, let's imagine this concept in the U.S.
Also, commercial broadcasters have to pay, I think it's about 5% of their gross revenue, into the Social Responsibility Fund. And they don't have public interest obligations like we supposedly have, but they do have basically a financial obligation to support non-commercial media. So I found that out real interesting. I have an article that I wrote about the Venezuelan media. It was in this, and I'll pass it around. You couldn't fit the whole thing in the newsletter, but the rest is on the website.
I was going to say about, I was at the grassroots radio conference in Madison a couple months ago, and we had a workshop on FCC laws and ways to resist them without jeopardizing your station. And a couple of things that I've noticed people actually do.
many songs that have, you know, indecent words in them, simply indecent words, and just the obsessively bleeping them out. You know, just playing it and then obsessively, you know, you have to play all the bleeps. And then people are like, why am I, you know, they're like, what? And then come on and talk about why you had to bleep those words.
And actually pre-producing it so you're not leaving it to chance at the last second to leave as it's being played. But people are making our own bleeped versions of those songs.
And the other thing is bleeping songs that don't have indecent words in them, where you're using sounds where you're trying to, like, insinuate that something could have been a word, but it's like it was just an innocent word. And so it can change the meaning of the song when you can, like, bleep out words or put in sounds instead.
I have to add in, too, that there have been some recent rulings as well that have said that bleeping out words doesn't necessarily keep you free from an indecency charge. If someone can reasonably ascertain what the word was bleeped out, they have dropped some indecency fines on that patient. Just be aware. So mother
yeah. I've heard that you now have to bleep the entire word where you can't have just the, you know, sounds at the beginning and the end of the word at all, but if you bleep the whole word.
Right.
On the matter of the FCC, I just want to say October 25th or the 28th in Seattle, the FCC's hearings are going to be here. So, folks from the left here, folks from the east side, please come over. Come down.
Will they be? You know where they will be?
Don't know yet, but we will.
And the date is in certain items, and somewhere around the 25th or 28th. But if you look at Reclaim the Media's website,
and by registry, you might be on a list that will probably go out right now.
Because I know we're almost out of time, but I know these two men had questions and we're waiting.
Kate, I have a question relating to the community network that we're supposedly talking about. If you could talk about locally produced content, shared content in El Salvador, and maybe what's an example of what a radio day is, how much music is there, how much public affairs?
Mm-hmm. I think a normal day, it's probably, I mean, it isn't most of it's music. They have an hour a day of local content in the morning and an hour in the evening, so 2 hours a day of local content, purely local content. And there's about a half an hour program that comes out of the capital that's national news. That's bringing together all the different radio stations together. They put them together at the national ARPA's office and deploy them by satellite to all the other stations. So there's about half an hour of that played twice a day. And then there's an hour of international news that comes from AMARC, Association of World Association of Community Radios, that they play twice a day too. So there's probably, so that's like 4 hours, 4.5 hours of news broadcasting a day, and there's music.
Is there a lot of intra-national inside the country cross-pollination of community radio?
Yeah, they do. It's like a half an hour a day of content from other stations that's coming in. And other big events, there's a lot more. Like when they're talking about CAFTA, there's a lot more. When they're having, you know, other big nationwide events, they're bringing coverage from all over the country a lot more. But a normal day, they have a half an hour play. But they're actually trying to expand that because, like, the national office right now in the capital isn't very big and they don't have many reporters there, but they're bringing in more reporters there, hopefully, that will be covering the national issues and helping get that out to the communities as well. So it should be expanding.
I think we got the symbol.
We got the winding finger in the air.
We're trying to get everybody together over at the showroom.
Let's go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.